Don't laugh. This is serious.
My name's J.R. Jones, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm also the husband of K.J. So, I don't understand that. I'd never heard of Grants Pass, Oregon, and I'm sorry. I did know where Oregon was, so that's a kind of a plus. I'm from Missoula, Montana now, and I have to tell you, whenever I moved up there, I didn't even know where Montana was. I knew it was north, and I knew it was west, but I didn't know exactly where it was. So anyhow, Oregon's a notch above Montana in that respect. But after we were invited to come here to share and to participate, about 3 weeks after that, Kay came running into the living room with a piece of paper, something that she had printed off the internet, and I'm looking for Tony R. He would be the guy with the eye patch. No? Okay. Let's go this way. Are you familiar with the Darwin Awards? Tony, from Grants Pass, Oregon, is the first runner-up for the year 2001. The only reason, she knows Tony, the only reason he didn't win is that he didn't die. Let me tell you about this. Tell me that this guy's not supposed to be here. Doctors at Portland University Hospital said an Oregon man shot through the skull by a hunting arrow is lucky to be alive and will be released soon from the hospital. Tony R., 25, lost his right eye last weekend during an initiation into a men's rafting club, Mountain Men Anonymous. Jesus. Here's the good part. This is serious. This is serious. A friend tried to shoot a beer can off his head, but the arrow entered Tony's right eye. And he's not here, huh? Okay. Whenever he gets here, you'll know why he's here, okay? So, just go ahead, Phil. Hey, you can do it. First off, I want to thank the committee for inviting us to share and to participate in your roundup. I'd like to thank Bryce and Dottie for picking us up at the airport. They were very gracious and they took us out to lunch. I do have to tell you something about Bryce. He has I'm sure a lot of you that are local here knows that he's really heavy into fishing. And he has a pond out back of his place, and he stocked it with crappie, and he's not getting any more fish than he put in there. And what happened was, and only an alcoholic would do this, is he stocked them. He wanted the biggest fish to stock it, so he picked all males. So we know why Bryce is here tonight, too. But anyhow, I also noticed that this is entitled The Rogue Roundup, and being a former police officer, my first thought was rogue cop. And at any rate, is there I hope, and I'll go ahead and ask, is there anybody here that's only been coming to Alcoholics for Anonymous for less than, let's say, 2 weeks, 3 weeks? Anybody? Outstanding. Really glad you're here. Do what? Oh, okay. You talking to me? I want to share with you people that are new. I haven't had a drink since February the 20th of 1981, and I don't say that to impress you. What I'm going to say next, I hope, will impress you, and that is that I'm as close to my next drunk as you are to yours, that I'm just one drink away. And we do this deal one day at a time, and it's an action thing. And it doesn't make any difference what your motives are for being here, okay? It's totally irrelevant. All you have to do is do certain things, and I'm really glad you're here. I had a person tell me early on, before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, he said, you can go to a speaker meeting, and you can pick all the differences that you want to find between you and that speaker. I didn't do that. That didn't happen to me. I never drank that much. Believe me, it's totally irrelevant. What you need to do that might save your life is try to find the similarities. Try to find something that you can lock in on those feelings. And I found that was very good advice. At any rate, like I said, my name is J.R. Jones, and I'm an alcoholic, and I had my first drink. I'm also a very sensitive alcoholic, so please don't laugh, because this is very serious. I want to know why there's one table that has a reserve sign on it. What's up with that? Okay, I'm just curious. Well, there's another table with a reserve sign, but nobody's sitting there. Okay, never mind. All right, we'll move on. I have these little fleeting moments. The thought just kind of skips in, skips out, so think nothing of it. Everything's going to be okay. I had my first drink when I was about 11 years old, and I had that drink probably for the same reason most of you had it. I wanted to feel a part of. I wanted to feel big. I wanted to be cool, you know. And a hush fell over the crowd. And I tell you what happened. Whenever I took that drink, it worked. It worked. It got rid of that feeling of inadequacy. It got rid of that fear. It made me feel a part of. And I drank through high school for that reason. I wanted to be hip, slick, and cool, and I wanted to be part of the crowd. Whenever I would have a few drinks, I just had a feeling of well-being, you know, just kind of like a calm would just come over me, you know, and I could really. I could really rap to the girls, and I could dance, and I could just do it all, you know? I mean, those were the days. Anyhow, get back to this. Seriously. So I drank through high school. When I got out of high school, I joined the Marine Corps, and, you know, Marines have been known occasionally to have a drink or two, and... Well, actually, Marines are steely-eyed, sex-crazed killers. And so you had to drink, you know. Okay, so they weren't all steely-eyed, but... And anyhow, I drank for the same reason in the Marine Corps. You know, I wanted to be a part of. You know, I didn't want to be less than. The reason why I joined the Marine Corps is because my brother was in the Marine Corps. And I had to, you know, or I'd been less than him. And so I joined the Marine Corps, and I drank there for the same reasons. You know, it was expected of me. But there was also another reason. There was a fear. I had that fear that I wasn't going to measure up, that I wasn't going to be able to do my job like you did yours, you know. And so I drank and had the opportunity to go to Vietnam. And you want to talk about fear? It really, really came into play there, and I found again with a few drinks, or quite a few drinks, that fear would go away. That hole in the gut with that cold wind blowing through would go away. That feeling of inadequacy would go away, and so I drank, and it worked for me. With a few drinks, I knew what I was doing. You know, I had it together, and I. Early on, like probably most of you, I would occasionally get sick drinking, and the first opportunity that I had to make a deal with God, I was in Quang Tri, South Vietnam, and come off the fire base off Hill 691, and I went back there and went to the Seabees Club, because Seabees thought Marines were all heroes, and we didn't have to buy drinks there. So anyhow, I kind of overshot the mark by one or two drinks. And to make a long story short, I'm outside of the club, and I'm on my hands and knees puking. And out of the corner of my eye, I see a red star cluster go up. And that's bad. For those of you that don't know, that's bad news. And that means they're coming in the wire. And so I made a deal with God. I said, God, if you get me out of this, I'll never get sick drinking again. And to this day, I have never got sick from drinking again. So, you know, I held up my end of the bargain. But anyhow, I drank through the Marine Corps. I come back from Vietnam and got out of the Marine Corps. I had in between there, I had hired out on a railroad, and then I took a leave of absence and went back in the Marine Corps so I could go to Vietnam. So when I came home, I went back to work on the railroad, and I don't know about nowadays, but back then, railroaders drank, okay, a lot, kind of like Marines. If there's any railroaders here in the crowd, just a little trivia I like to toss out. There's 17 places on a diesel locomotive you can hide a six-pack. And I knew where they all were. On the railroad, this is what's kind of, I don't know whether it's funny or sad. I kind of think it's sad now looking back. But I drank on the railroad for the same reason I drank in the Marine Corps. I was afraid. I was afraid I wouldn't measure up. I was afraid I wouldn't do my job like the other guys did theirs. You know, and with a few drinks, I could do it. I could do it. I worked, was in Indianapolis, and they were out of people over in Danville, Illinois, which was my hometown, and I went over there and worked from Danville, Illinois to Chicago for 3 months. And I can't tell you how to get from Danville to Chicago by rail. I was in a blackout every trip. Evidently, I did fine. I'm here, you know. But I ended up, worked for about 6 months on the railroad and decided that I needed to do something. I still hadn't validated myself, so I went on the police department. Just picture me. Gun and a badge. It's awesome. It's not funny, this is serious, folks. But again, on the police department, I drank for the same reason I drank in high school. I drank for the same reason I drank in the Marine Corps. I drank for the same reason I drank on the railroad. I was afraid. I was afraid I wouldn't measure up. You know, I had that hole in the gut with that cold wind blowing through. I had that feeling of inadequacy. And I found out that with a few drinks, and I heard a gentleman in Alcoholics Anonymous say it before, with a few drinks, I became larger and more self-contained, and they became smaller and less threatening. In fact, I became about 6'8", 280, and bulletproof. And the strange thing about that, you know, I'm sure that I look about 6'8", 280 standing here tonight. I had one gentleman right before the meeting said, "You're about 6'4", aren't you?" Yeah, I'm 6'5 and a half, but not really. I lied. But I found that if I drank enough, I was invincible. And I would do stupid things. Would stop a car with four or five people in it and wouldn't call headquarters, wouldn't tell them what I was doing. And people on my district thought I was nuts. You know, they thought I was crazy, which in retrospect was kind of a good thing. I weigh 210 pounds now. Whenever I was a cop, right before I quit drinking, I weighed 134 pounds. What? I was 6'1", 134 pounds, a romping, stomping barroom hell, okay? Oh. But, all right, I overlooked something here. I know there may be one or two of you here that may have had a bad experience with the police. There may be a couple of you that's probably even been arrested. So, I want you to know one thing. I was fair. I tell you what I used to do. See, all right, I'll let you be the judge. You're laughing, I'll let you be the judge. We had a breathalyzer van that a police women didn't work in cars back then, okay? I'm not even going to go there. Not even going to go there. But anyhow, they didn't work in cars. But they had this breathalyzer van, and this one policewoman, her name was Pam Kramer, good-looking blonde. And they had this van, so if I stopped somebody for DUI, instead of having to drive all the way downtown to the police headquarters to get my breath test, we just call for the van and they would come out and give my breath test. Now, here goes. Okay. Clear your minds, be open-minded about this, okay? I would take the test too. This is serious. I would take the test too, and if I tested higher than they did, I'd let them go. Now, is that fair? Okay. Huh? I thought it was. And I'll tell you right now, I could blow a .25 at any time of the day or night. You know. Now, the other side of that coin was, is I normally didn't stop anybody unless they were bouncing off of parked cars or curbs or whatnot, you know. But, and again, for those of you think, well, geez, that's terrible. I didn't let them drive home. I'd call their wife or their girlfriend to come and pick them up. I mean, you know, I was looking out for public safety, for Christ's sake. But I was fair. You know, I thought that was kind of a good deal. And she used to, Pam Kramer, my God, she'd have thought I killed her firstborn every time I do that. She'd get all upset, like we're going to get suspended or fired or something. It's like, Pam, you got to give them a fighting chance out here. She just didn't understand. Of course, in retrospect, if she understood, she'd be here tonight, you know. She'd be the Sunday morning spiritual speaker. But, you know, you do things like that. You know, I like to have fun. I always had a soft spot in my heart for the drunk, you know. I broke my hands and wrists 5 times, and each time that I would, I'd end up driving the paddy wagon, and I'd go downtown Indianapolis, and especially in the wintertime, and round them up, and I just had a soft spot in my heart for the drunk, you know, and I never knew why. You know, it used to aggravate me. Some of the cops would pick on them, and shove them around and whatnot. It just disgusted me, and now I know why. You know, hell, I was looking at a little bit of me there, but I do remember one night. Any of you that's ever been to Indianapolis, across from the Marion County Jail, they had an elevated parking lot, and why in the hell we wanted to go there to drink, I don't know. But a bunch of us, about 6 or 8 of us, we worked one-man cars. And we went up there on this elevated parking lot. It's kind of abandoned at about 2-3 in the morning, and we got several cases of beer and several quarts of whiskey and whatnot. And anyhow, we're standing there drinking and yucking it up and having a heck of a good time. And the back of this parking lot is an old abandoned black Cadillac on blocks, you know. And somebody, I don't know why, but anyhow, they just... All of a sudden, they just drew down and popped a cap and shot this car. And so that's kind of like waving the green flag at the Indy 500. So now all of us are, you know, we're shooting and reloading and shooting, and guys getting their shotguns out and shooting, and just, you know, big smoke. And, you know, it's like a war zone. And there's a doctor here tonight. Awesome. Good. But anyhow, you're just shooting and shooting, and this car, I mean, when we got done, there wasn't 4 square inches of that car that didn't have bullet holes in it. And finally, you know, hell, shit, we're out of bullets. And the door just kind of creaks open. Yeah, you know what's going to happen, don't you? And this wino... crawls out of this car saying, "Don't shoot," you know. And I'm thinking this guy had to have been curled up in his watch pocket, a target 4 inches, because he didn't have a scratch on him, you know. And I'm thinking, God takes care of drunks and fools. And we were both, you know. And but for the grace of God, we didn't all end up in prison for murdering that man. And is he here tonight? He may not have had a spiritual awakening yet, but I guarantee you he had a rude awakening that night. And I tell you something else, he went on a pretty good drunk too, because we give him more money than we even gave our wives. So, But I figure one of these times, you know, he's going to be there in the back and he's going to say, yeah, that was me, you son of a... But alcohol had become a very important part of my life, and I had to drink it to function. I had to drink it to be able to do that job, because I was so afraid. I worked the ghetto and the whole time that I was there, and I give you an example on the. The police department there. One night I was involved in a police action shooting and shot and killed an individual. And again, this was the one night that I can even remember, the only night that I didn't have anything to drink before I went to work, and I had not had anything to drink before the incident. Again, God takes care of drunks and fools. But shot and killed this individual, and it was on a Saturday night, and the police chief and his wife just happened to be out to dinner, and he heard it over the police radio, and he came to the scene, and he told me, he said, you need to go downtown to make a sworn tape statement down at the homicide branch of what happened. And the only thing that I could ask this man, the chief of police of the 10th largest city in the country, was, would it be all right if I stopped and got a six-pack on the way downtown? What? Some of you are looking at me like I've got an eye right here in the middle of my forehead. That's the logical thing to ask, folks. I'm an alcoholic. I've got a situation here. I've got a guy laying dead in the street that said he had a gun, and he didn't. He lied. I've got a situation here that's unacceptable. Now, what's the only thing that I can do to change this situation? I can have a few drinks. And after a few drinks, the situation stays the same, but it looks different to me. It becomes acceptable. The chief remembered that statement a hell of a lot longer than I did. And I ended up, after 6 years, I left that job. And I left in good stead, by the way. In fact, my last 6 months on the department, I got 4 commendations. Some of the details of those are a little fuzzy, but at any rate, I left that job and went back to work on the railroad, and continued drinking out there. The problem was, and see, I was a functioning drunk. I didn't stagger when I walked. I didn't slur my words when I talked. For all practical purposes, I was just like I am right now. Well, I didn't wear the flower, but for all practical purposes, I was like I am right now. You know, sometimes, you know, occasionally, I, you know, maybe would have an attitude problem. Yeah, she's nodding. So, yeah, occasionally I'd have an attitude problem, but. I was a functioning drunk, and I felt yeah, I can handle it. You know, we had a doctor there that wrote an article in the newspaper about alcoholism, and a column, and I read it, and I was an alcoholic. I get a big kick out of it at Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, have somebody come to a meeting, and they get all choked up. They can't say it. I don't know what the hell the big deal is, but because I knew I was alcoholic long before I quit drinking. Yes, I'm alcoholic, but no, I'm not one of them. I can handle it, you know. I was able to consume large amounts of alcohol and continue to function, quote, normally. And I thought nobody was the wiser. Again, I found out that wasn't exactly true. But at any rate, I was starting to have to drink more to get rid of that fear. I was having to drink more to get rid of that hole in the gut with that cold wind blowing through. I was having to drink more to feel, to get rid of that feeling of loneliness. And when I talk about loneliness, I'm talking about being in a crowd like this and thinking, but they just don't understand. They just don't understand how I feel. They just don't understand what I'm going through. You know, if they knew, they'd have a few drinks too. You know, and it got to where it took more and more. And what was even worse than that, God forbid, was I started to get drunk. I started staggering when I worked, bumping into stuff. You know, started slurring my words. I started losing control of bodily functions. I'm not going to go there either. But, you know, just... And I thought I was sick. I did. I thought, I'm dying. You know, hell, I thought I had cancer. You know, I was only eating, you know, maybe part of a meal every third day. And like I say, I was 134 pounds, kind of had this yellowish-gray tint to me. And I was dying, you know. And then the absolute worst thing that can happen to this alcoholic happened. It stopped working. I couldn't get enough. And I remember the last night that I drank, I went to bed and I left a half a drink sitting on the table. And I'd never done that. Hell, when we went out drinking, I wouldn't let anybody else leave a half a drink on the table. You know, after last call, we get ready to leave, and I'd turn around and look, and where's a half a drink? Hell, I'd go back and finish it. You know, we was talking of waste not, want not. You know, that's in the Bible, Nels. You know. He's the spiritual speaker Sunday morning, if you can believe that. But, and that particular night, though, I left a half a drink on the table. And I went to bed, and I'm here to tell you, that was the most peaceful night's sleep that I had had in my life. Just slept like a baby. And the next morning, when I got up and I walked into the bathroom and I looked in the mirror, I wasn't there. The realization, it was kind of like that old expression, the lights are on but nobody's home. And the realization hit me that I'll never, ever be able to drink again. And I'll tell you, that was and still is one of the most depressing days of my life. Because I had to surrender. I had to surrender to alcohol. I had to take the first half of the first step. And surrenders against my nature, by the way, like it is yours. I didn't want to give up. I didn't want to throw the towel in. But I knew the party was over. And then the next thought that crossed my mind was, I'll never, ever be able to have fun again. What are you laughing for? This is serious business here. Yeah, I'll never, ever. But my whole life centered around drinking. You know, we went places, people drank. You know, how in the hell are you going to have any fun if you don't drink? Beats the hell out of me. But I quit drinking. And that doctor that wrote that article, he used a lot of the AA stuff. You know, he said, you do it one day at a time. Well, I couldn't do it a day at a time. I couldn't do it an hour at a time. I had to go 5 minutes at a time. Anybody can go 5 minutes without a drink. And I went 15 minutes without a drink. But I put those 5 minutes together, and I was in that bedroom. I don't know. I don't know whether it was 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, 6 days. And I did all the things that alcoholics do, except die in DTs. I saw things. I felt things crawling on me, and I had the chills. Was freezing cold, and I had the sweats, was fiery hot, and I had nightmares, and I saw things on fire in the room, and I had dry heaves, and I did everything that alcoholics do except die. And again, God takes care of drunks and fools. And I should have died in that bedroom. My wife, at that point in our marriage, was not real sympathetic. Just a loving observation. But the best thing I got out of that deal with her was I asked for a cold, wet wash rag, and she gave me one. She threw it at me, and she didn't even wring it out. I hate that. But I put those 5 minutes together, and then the minutes became hours, and the hours became days, and the days became months. And I didn't go to AA. You see, I had heard from well-meaning people that loved me that all you have to do is quit drinking and everything will be okay. What? What are you laughing for? This is serious business here. I had heard that all you had to do is quit drinking and everything will be okay. And like I said, yes, I was alcoholic. But no, I wasn't one of them. You know, I mean, what's an alcoholic? You know, Alcoholics Anonymous, that's the guy that lives underneath the bridge that's got one black shoe, one brown shoe, a long brown overcoat, and all his worldly possessions in a grocery sack. That's an alcoholic, okay? I didn't need AA, thank you. And I went 15 months without a drink. And I want to tell you, people around me really started getting on my nerves. They really started to act up. And I got to thinking, now wait a minute. If I'm alcoholic and I quit drinking, and it's not okay, in fact, it's getting worse, maybe, just maybe, I'm not really an alcoholic. Maybe I'm just crazy. Huh? How's that for an option? You know? And I heard a gentleman in Alcoholics Anonymous share this, and I firmly believe it. And this is very important, especially for the new people here and the old people here. The most fatal, fatal symptom of this disease is my own mind telling me that I don't really have it. Not really. Not like you guys do. But mine's more a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings. And that's what was happening at that point in my life, is that that symptom was creeping in, telling me that, well, you quit drinking, you're being good, and it's getting worse. Maybe you're not really an alcoholic. But I also had somebody tell me that, why don't you go to AA, you know? You can go to AA and you can just feel bad, and you don't even have to say anything at the meeting, and after the meeting you just feel better. And again, it's like, I don't need AA. I'm staying sober. I was just Sammy Serenity at that point in my life. But anyhow, I took a buyout from the railroad and moved down to Shreveport, Louisiana, a town that I didn't know a soul in. I'd never been there before in my life. Started a business that I didn't know a whole hell of a lot about. And I went down... before Kay did, that's KJ, before she did and the sons, and I went down to kind of get things organized. And as I said, during those 15 months, those feelings of inadequacy, the feeling of impending doom, that hole in the gut with that cold wind blowing through, the anxiety and the tension and the fear intensified like you wouldn't believe. And what happened was I found myself there in Shreveport in my office, pulling the shades, closing and locking the door, and hiding under my desk. And as I'm sitting under there, I'm thinking, this is not normal behavior. And the second thought was that what that person had told me, why don't you go to AA? Why don't you give them a call? And I'm under the desk, and here's my options. I stay under this desk forever, or I can call Alcoholics Anonymous. So make a long story short, I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and they said, yeah, there's a meeting tonight at 8 o'clock at the Lutheran Church on Flournoy Lucas Road. And so I started out relatively early trying to find that meeting, about 45 minutes early. And for anybody that's never been to Shreveport, Louisiana, it's the street construction capital of the world. I mean, their streets are tore up all the time, okay? And when they tear their streets up, they take their street signs down. So I'm driving around looking for Flournoy Lucas Road, and I can't find it. And it's starting to kind of get closer to 8 o'clock, and I'm starting to kind of drive a little faster and, them kind of easy rolling stops, and I still can't find it. And the closer it gets to 8 o'clock, the faster I'm driving, until finally I'm just blowing stop signs. And the feeling that I got, I mean, I had to find that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that night. I had to find it. I don't know what the hell would have happened if I didn't. You'd probably had a different speaker here tonight. But I had to find that meeting. And I'm sure a couple of you can relate to this. The feeling was the exact same feeling I used to have when I was out of booze and trying to find a tavern before last call so I could get some more. You know, that absolute total desperation. And I found that meeting. I found that meeting there at the Lutheran Church, and I pulled in the parking lot, got out, and looked around to see if anybody saw me going in. And then I'm thinking, well, ain't a soul in Shreveport. I don't know a soul here. You know what? And I'm looking around to see if somebody sees me going in. And I go in, and a gentleman meets me at the door. His name was Russell, who became my sponsor. And it was a discussion meeting, and we sat down, and you know what the topic was? Anyone? Anyone? Bueller? Bueller? Anyone? God. I want to tell you, at that point in my life, I didn't know if there even was a God. My thought was, if there was a God, I wouldn't have been in the shape I was in. Okay? And they're talking about God. Now, getting back three minutes and 48 seconds. When I made that call to Alcoholics Anonymous, I took the second half of the first step. My life was unmanageable. See, that's the feelings. That's alcoholism. That's that hole in the gut with the cold wind blowing through. That's the anxiety and the tension and the fear and the loneliness. But I sat down at that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I looked around. So does she. He does too. Wonder if they've been to Indianapolis. Wonder if I locked him up. You know, damn, he looks familiar too. And they were familiar, because I was seeing a little bit of me sitting around that room. Because I was an alcoholic, and I was one of you. And I saw a little bit of me sitting in each one of those chairs. And after the meeting, I went to coffee with Russell, and I told him, I said, you know, I'm having a little problem with this God bit. And I told him what I told you, you know, about didn't know if there even was a God. And he told me something that I'm quite confident saved my life. He said, you don't have to believe in God. I said, you don't? He said, no. He said, all you have to believe is that we do. and keep coming back. I said, oh. Again, motives didn't have any bearing on it. A few days later, I went to another meeting, and Russell was again at the door, and he had a big book for me. And we went to coffee. And he said, when you get home at night, he said, get down on your knees and thank God for a day of sobriety. And I said, whoop, time out. Time out, Russell. I thought I told you about this God bit that I don't know if I even believe in God. He said, you don't have to believe in God. You have to take the actions. You have to get down on your knees and say the words. I said, okay, I can do that. And what I found out here in Alcoholics Anonymous was, is there are a lot of things that I had to do that I didn't believe in, that I didn't think would work for me, that I thought was corny, stupid, dumb, some of it just downright childish. I mean, stand up after a meeting, hold hands, and pray. Come on. And Russell said, you need to do it. And it doesn't make any difference what it looks like to you. You don't have to believe in it. And if you're new here tonight, you don't have to believe in it. Your motives are totally irrelevant. You just have to take the action. Alcoholics Anonymous, and again, I heard this in AA. Everything I say up here, I've heard from somebody else. You know, they shared it with me, and I'll share it with you. Is that all you have to do is take the actions. That Alcoholics Anonymous is unlike any other therapy in the world. All the others say change your thinking and eventually your actions will change. Alcoholics Anonymous says change your actions and eventually your thinking will change. You know? And it worked. And I started doing stuff that he suggested. He'd call me up. He'd call me up at like 5:30 and he'd say, yeah, get ready, going to pick you up at 6 o'clock. We're going to a meeting up in El Dorado, Arkansas. Or, you know, I'm going to pick you up at 6:30. We're going to go over to Tyler, Texas. Or we're going to Debury, Texas. Or, you know, I'll pick you up at 5:45. We're going to Hope, Arkansas. And it's like, Russell, what the hell are we going? What are we going to Arkansas for? And he said, because you're liable to hear something that you need to hear. They're liable to say something that you need to hear. And so we'd go. We drove all over Hell's Half Acre in Arkansas and East Texas and North Louisiana going to meetings so I could hear things that I needed to hear. But I did that. I did that. And the business, of course, it was, you know, you take an alcoholic, starts a business he doesn't know anything about, in a town he doesn't know anything about, that his head is totally screwed up. And I was having problems. They had this woman there with the Better Business Bureau. Jesus, she used to just cause me. She with the Better Business Bureau. But this woman just, I mean, she just griped my butt, okay? And Russell, you know what he told me to do? Pray for her. I said, okay, I'll pray for her, but I ain't going to mean it. And again, he said, you don't have to mean it. You just have to do it. And I did that. And I'd complain about the business. You know, it's just, God, the guys aren't doing what they're supposed to, and this is happening, and that's happening. And he'd say, okay, get the keys to the Monday night meeting and open up and set up the chairs. And it's like, Russell, you know, obviously you don't understand the gravity of this situation. You know? And he said, no, you just do these things. And I said, okay. I made a mistake of complaining about the coffee one night at the Monday night meeting. I made coffee for a year and a half. I've never complained about the coffee at an AA meeting since. But I did that. I did that. I cleaned ashtrays. I put up chairs. I did all that stupid stuff. Prayed for those people that just, I just wanted to just choke them until their little feet stopped kicking. You know? And it just, but I did it. I did it because Russell said to do it. And I found that whenever I did it, I felt better. I felt better. I'd say, "Thy will be done," and that bitch's life as well as mine. But after doing that every day for 2 weeks, at the end I found myself saying, "Thy will be done in her life as well as mine." And it worked for me. And again, you know, this is an action program. Getting back to that very first meeting, you know, when I looked at those people and I knew them. Also, there was something else that was very unusual about them. They appeared to be okay. They appeared to be comfortable. Some of them even appeared to be happy. But I thought they were faking it. And you see, I had tried everything in my power for 15 months to be okay. And I was getting worse. And sitting there looking around that room of Alcoholics Anonymous, these people appeared to be okay. And you see, I didn't want to be 6'8", 280, and bulletproof anymore. I just wanted to be okay. And at that first meeting, I feel that I took the second step. I came to believe that there was a power greater than me that could make me okay. Could make me okay. And then, you know, the third step. This is one of my biggies. I'm ready to go off on a rant here. And I'm guilty of it. I did it. You know, I'm having trouble with the third step. The hell's to have trouble with? You know, it's make a decision. That's all. You know? Let me make it real, real clear. Russell said you got to keep it simple for you, meaning me, is in. All right, the first step, we admitted we're powerless over alcohol, but our lives have become unmanageable. What that means is when I drink, it's bad. When I don't drink, it's bad. That's all. That's all, folks. You know, I got two problems in the first step. The second step is the solution to the two problems. The third step is simply making a decision if I want the solution to those two problems. That's all. Keep it simple. That's all it is. Make a decision. Now, if I want the solution, then I have to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. Now, what's my will and my life? That's my thoughts and my actions. That's all it is, just my thoughts and my actions. And I turn it over to the care of a higher power. That doesn't mean I turn it over to God and sit on my butt and not do anything. No. It means I still take the actions, I just leave the results up to that power greater than me. Okay? How do I turn my will and my life over to the care of that God? I take the rest of the steps. You know? Now, I've also come to believe, and this may injure some of you, I hope you're not as sensitive as I am, but I found that most people that complain that they're having trouble with the third step, it's because they don't want to take the fourth step. Okay? Chew on that for a while. I might take a drink. This thing made ice cubes while I wasn't looking. This is awful. That's a spiritual experience. And I almost choked. Did you do that? That's why they didn't clap when you read the steps. And they clapped when she read, because you've got a mean streak. Yeah. Okay. Keep an eye on her, will you, Kelly? Okay. But the fourth step, if there's anything that I could go back in Alcoholics Anonymous and change, it would be this bad misconception that there's something difficult about the fourth step. I mean, come on. You know, the fourth step, that's my thoughts and my actions. Hell, I was the only one that was there for all of it, so I'm not going to put down anything that I don't already know. There ain't any surprises, you know. So what's the big deal? Huh? I mean, think about it. Let's have a show of hands, the ones of you that are kind of hesitating to take the fourth step. I didn't think so. Thank you. I like you. You're the only one who was there for all of it, bud. Put it down. Now, you know, all we're doing here is just making it tangible, putting it in black and white so we can deal with it. You know? The fifth step. admit to God, to ourselves, another human being. You know, big deal. I was Catholic. That was no big thing. Except I disguised my voice. So that was no big thing. Saw a billboard coming. No, I'm not even going to get into that either. Outside of town. What's up with that? That billboard that's out there between the airport and here. You know the one I'm talking about, right? Yeah, what the hell's up with that? Okay. Anyhow, the fifth step, share it with another human being, you know? If you got a whole lot of stuff, if we're talking some legal problems here, you know? You don't have to put all your eggs in one basket. You can take your fifth step with more than one person. You know? Put all your eggs in one basket. You're liable to end up with all your eggs in prison somewhere. You know? But the fifth step, you're just sharing it with God, yourself, and another human being. No big deal. The sixth step, seventh step, you know, asking Him to remove your shortcomings. I wish you'd have read How It Works. You know, they're talking about half measures availed us nothing. This is one of those fleeting thoughts, by the way. Why in the hell doesn't half measures avail us half? Anybody know? I don't understand it. But, by the way, the first meeting I went to, they had the steps and the traditions on the little window blind deal. I worked the steps in, 20 minutes. Russell didn't buy that either. But we asked Him to remove our shortcomings. Okay? Making a list of all the people that we had harmed. I had a problem with this because I told Russell, and I'm kind of a logical kind of a guy. And I told him, I said, yeah, Russell, but they were 95%. He said, whoop, 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 whoop. Don't make any difference what they said. This isn't their eighth step. He said, this is yours. He said, if you're 1% here, put it down. That's not fair either. It's kind of like that goes in the same category, that half measures bit, availing us nothing. But I make the list, you know. And in the ninth step, making direct amends, you know. Do you ever wonder why the people that screwed over you don't have a program? All the people that owe me money aren't in AA. You know? It don't even out. But you take these actions. We had a guy at a meeting last night. My wife made me go to a meeting. And she said, well, are you going to a meeting tonight? And I said, no, I think I'm going to pack. She said, I think you ought to go to a meeting. I don't know what that meant. I think that was one of those loving observations. But this guy is at the meeting last night, and he says, you know, he said, make a long story short, he had 11 years, went back out, and the last 5 years he's been trying to get back in, and he's never put more than 6 months together. And finally he says, you know, he said, this is the first time that I'm doing what other people tell me to do, to wit, work the steps. And he's at the fourth step, and he said, you know, I'm doing what other people are telling me to do, and he said, everything's just out of whack, man. He said, everything's just terrible in my life. He said, you know, it doesn't work. And my first thought was, half measures avail us nothing, you know. The big book tells us that after the ninth step, if we're painstaking in that phase of our development, that we'll be surprised. You know, and we'll get the promises. But those first nine steps is where I have to kind of take responsibility for my own actions and make amends. And I want to tell you about making amends. And we have three sons, and Kay had two sons before we got married. And I never laid a hand on those boys physically, but mentally I beat the hell out of them. You know, I was a troop handler in infantry training regiment after ITR. I was a platoon sergeant in the brig. I was a platoon sergeant in Vietnam. I was a cop in the ghetto, and those kids didn't stand a chance if you want to play mind games. And, you know, how do you make amends for that? You know? I got to tell you this. I hear people at meetings, a lot of the women, you know, they say, well, they kind of neglect their kids, you know, or they
they would get drunk and they wouldn't make dinner or whatnot. When Kay and I got married, we ended up got a free apartment on the south side of town, and I had security. And so we moved, and the oldest boy was five and a half, and he went to school. And we moved, and of course we were all drinking, and it was all cops helping us move, and we're yucking it up. And at about 4:30, it dawned on us, damn, what about Perry, you know? So I called a state trooper buddy of mine who was the best man at our wedding. He happened to be working, and he said, Jerry, could you swing by 3010 Midvale there and Perry come home from school? And we'd moved. And he didn't know it. And, he's 5 1/2 year old, and he looks in the windows, and all the furniture's gone. There's no note. And Jerry said that when he pulled up, he said Perry was sitting there on the front steps like this. And it's kind of funny. it's funny now. It was funny then, too, now that I think about it. But how do you make amends for that? To make amends, by the way, is not saying I'm sorry. To make amends is to change a wrong and make it right. And how do you do that? How do you do that with kids? You know? And I had to think long and hard about that. And what I've done is I've made them my buddies. They're my pals. They're not my sons only. Yes, they're my sons, but they're also my friends. And me and the oldest boy, the one that was sitting on the front steps, and we moved with no forwarding address. God, that tickles me. We talk about once a week. He calls, and we share a couple of common interests, you know, and we laugh and we have fun. And the other son, he's an engineer on the railroad, and he's my best friend, you know. And we do stuff together, you know. That's, to me, that's making amends. And then the youngest son, you know, he's we got a seat dusted off for him. Maybe that's what that table's reserved for, where nobody's at. That's for Eddie. But we told him that, and he told me. He said, I'm just not quite ready yet, Dad. And I said, I know exactly how you feel, Ed. I know exactly how you feel. Tell you what, though, he's going to have some pretty good stories from up here. I got one, and I can't tell it because Kay told me I couldn't tell it. But boy, he's got one that'll just knock your socks off. Knocked his off. I'm going to tell you. I got to tell you. This is just too good to be true. He's at this bar in Montana. Every town in Montana has a bar called Stockman's, okay? And he's in, she's been to Stocks. And he's in Stocks, and he runs out of money, and the bartender, he's got a stun gun behind the bar. And the bartender tells him, he says, Eddie's a compulsive gambler, too. He's been known to take a bet. He says, I tell you what. He said, if you'll drop your trowel and let me zap you with this stun gun, your private parts, you can drink free, you and your buddies, for the rest of the night. Eddie said his eyes crossed as he was going to his knees. That's my boy. That's Kay's son. But last summer, Hell's Angels came to Missoula for their yearly vacation, and Eddie, whenever he drinks, sometimes he gets an attitude problem, and so I was willing to pay for him a weekend to Vegas, you know, just to get him out of town. And he said, no, there's a hoop fest up in Polson, big response up there. And he said, I'm going up there for the hoop fest for the weekend, Dad. And I said, great, Ed. Well, he stopped by Stocks that Thursday afternoon before he started up to Polson, and the Hells Angels had gotten down a day early, and they were at Stocks. So Eddie and Brandon, his buddy, we got the second seat for him, they end up drinking with these Hells Angels. And in fact, Charlie Barger, who was the the kingpin was there, and the story about the stun gun come out, and Charlie said, "Hell, if I had extra colors," he said, "I'd make you a member right now, man." You know. But anyhow, we'll get on with that. I just had to tell you about that because I'm so proud of that boy. But he's fun. He really is. He's just neat, you know. He got fired from the railroad for laying off sick, and they caught him at the bowling alley, and he was off for 2 years, and we took it to an arbitration board, and he just got his job back, and the railroad's got to pay him both years' back pay, and it just... I said, "Hey, what are you going to do with your money?" He said, "Well, it's kind of..." He said, "I've always wanted to play in the World Series of Poker, Dad." But anyhow, he's going to make it, and whenever he does, he'll do all right, and he's great, and he's my buddy too, and we have a lot of laughs, and we just harass the hell out of his mother, and that's fun, you know. I can say something, and then he'll say the same thing at the exact same time with a straight face, and it's just it's awesome. But anyhow, getting back to the steps, the steps for me is recovery. They say that there are no musts in Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, if you want to be sober and have any serenity whatsoever, there are musts, and there's 12 of them. My sponsor told me, he said, J.R., he said, you need to change everything about yourself. You need to change your language. You need to change your thoughts. You need to change your actions. You need to change your playmates. You need to change your playpens. And Alcoholics Anonymous has 12 tools that I can use to do that. And again, whether I think they'll work for me or not is totally irrelevant. Whether I think they're corny, dumb, or stupid is totally irrelevant. If I take the actions, I can get the desired results. I have come to believe that if I am an alcoholic like you are, and I believe that I am, that if I do the same thing that you did to get okay, there's a damn good chance that I'll get okay too. And I'll tell you, it's a hell of a deal. The idea that I'll never ever be able to have fun again, we proved that wrong tonight. Because this is a kick. And I'll tell you, quite frankly, you look like you've been a pretty good bunch to drink with. You know, call me crazy. Call me crazy. But I guess the bottom line is, you don't have to work the steps. You have to take them. With steps, you take them, and you apply them in your life on a daily basis. And we take the 10th step to correct the problems that we have and to make amends for the things that we do wrong now, because we're human. We never rise above basic human being. And the 11th step, you know, I sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God. And I do choose to call Him God, and I'm not embarrassed about that, and I don't have to whisper that. My higher power is God. And the 12th step to carry the message, you know, you can carry the message here. There's people still suffering in Alcoholics Anonymous at these meetings, and I found out why. Because there's times that I've suffered, and it's because I stopped doing the things that I was doing. We had an old boy in Shreveport, his name's George, and he got sober on August 12th of 1948. And, you hear these old, crusty old coots a lot of time, and they say, "Yeah, keep coming back, it gets better." And, we ask him, flat out, "George, when's it get better?" And George says, your life is like a graph, and you got your ups and you got your downs. And he said, if you do these things, if you take these actions in Alcoholics Anonymous, eventually your ups get higher and your downs don't get quite as low until eventually even your downs are above that zero starting line. And that's what we guarantee you here. And if you do the steps, it guarantees you, you know, there's promises in there. And I read them and I thought, man, this is cool, all these promises. You know, I'm thinking I'm going to be rich and I'm going to be famous and my relationship with my wife is going to be great and all that. And 12 promises don't say that. You know, that's like the one that says, you know, fear of financial insecurity will leave you. You know, that doesn't mean you're going to be rich. That just means you ain't going to be afraid to be broke. You know? That's the bottom line. You know, that's the bottom line. says you'll know a new freedom, and that's my favorite one, because that new freedom is a freedom of choice, and that's not a choice on whether I drink or whether I don't. That freedom of choice is a choice on whether how I want to feel at any given time of any given day. And this is very important for me. I don't have to give other people the power to control my emotions. I don't have to react when they push the buttons or pull the strings. That decision is mine now. It didn't used to be, because I used to carry a gun and a badge and had an attitude. But now I have the freedom of choice, and Alcoholics Anonymous gave me that freedom of choice. And it's a hell of a deal. I was talking with Nels, and he said, you know, if we'd have had to make a list when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous on what we expected to get out of this deal, we'd have sold ourselves way, way, way short. Way short. It's what it's like now. I've had the opportunity in my sobriety. We was talking about Nels mentioned Stepping Stones. That's Bill Wilson's home in Bedford Hills, New York. And I had the opportunity whenever my lovely wife, when she was the delegate for the state of Montana for Al-Anon, that she was the head sick. When she went back to the World Service Conference, I went back there for a weekend and had the opportunity to go to Stepping Stones. And my sponsor, Russell's a taper, and he taped the Al-Anon World Service Conference. And I got to go to Stepping Stones with my sponsor. And we got to go into that little cabin, Wits End, and sit at Bill Wilson's desk, me and my sponsor. And we took a bunch of pictures, but it was about our fourth time in because we couldn't take the pictures because of the tears that were flowing. And you stand there and you realize what was done at that desk with all those cigarette burns on it. And you think, man, oh man, what a deal. You know, one more drink and I could have missed it all. You know, I've had the opportunity to take some trips. I went to the Bahamas, Kay and I, went out to Paradise Island and playing golf. And on one of the holes, you walk up to an elevated green. And when you get up there, you look out and there's the blue water, you know. And then the tears just come to my eyes. And it's like one more drink and I could have missed it all, you know. The 12th step, carrying the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. I was blessed with the opportunity to 12-step my brother. And I went out to Arizona, and he was living in a 12-foot by 12-foot concrete block building in the desert. Just him and his Rottweiler dog to keep the demons away. And I was able to 12-step Herb. And I ended up taking him back to Shreveport, because he didn't have any pressing business engagements. And my sponsor, Russell, and his lovely wife, Betty, who's KJ's sponsor, were there coincidentally at our kitchen table when we got home from the airport. And Herb mentioned that, you know, he said, boy, thanks, you guys are just so positive. You're just so positive. And I let him read the big book to explain to him why I was the way I was. And I let him listen to a tape that would maybe explain why I was the way I was. And we went out to dinner at a steak and ale, and Herb had a Heineken's beer. That was his last drink. He says if he'd have known it was going to be his last one, he'd have had two. But the next night I took him to a meeting out at the VA hospital because I was chairing the meeting out there. I chaired the meeting at the VA for a year and a half. And I found out just a year ago that Herb thought I was taking him out there. He said he thought I was going to have him committed. But he got sober, and last month he would have had 18 years. But he died on my AA birthday, February the 20th of this year. And You know, at first thought, that's terrible, but at second thought, it's awesome, because he told me the day before, he said, you know, little brother, he said, I'm going to be one of the 10% of us alcoholics that's going to die sober. And so now, when I celebrate my birthday, I celebrate his sobriety, because he died sober. And that's a gift that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. Who'd have held a thought it? Who'd have thought it? Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was blessed with the privilege of being a part of his sobriety and part of his life. And the reason why I was blessed with that gift was because of you people. You gave it so freely to me. When I came in here, stark raving mad and crazy, you shared with me and you told me what I had to do to be okay. And I did that. And so I was blessed. And you know, we hear everybody has a bunch of wants, and I had a bunch of wants. But I find out that it's the needs. And in the back of the third edition of the big book, don't get me going on that, it'll be a whole other hour. But towards the back of the book, I believe it's, I don't know what the hell it is, 552. So anyhow, it says in there that I get everything I need in Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything I need, I get. And when I get what I need, invariably, I find out that it's just what I wanted all the time. Again, thank you very much.